Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
9 million tons of plastic end up in oceans each year. It never degrades and can float around for decades. Today, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Edward Humes takes us on a journey inside the secret world of our trash and tells us the story of the Chico entrepreneur who came up with an alternative to plastic grocery bags. Later in the hour, Reading author Steve Westall takes us to New Hope Island, a tropical paradise filled with love, joy, and adventure. My guest today is the author of 11 critically acclaimed nonfiction books, including Monkey Girl, Eco Barons, and the bestseller Mississippi Mud. Journalist Edward Humes has received the Pulitzer Prize, the Penn Award, and numerous other awards for his journalism and books. He has written for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and Los Angeles Magazine. His latest book takes us on a journey inside the secret world of our biggest export, our trash. Garbology, our dirty love affair with trash, digs through our epic piles of trash to reveal not just what we throw away, but who we are and where our society is headed. Edward Humes, welcome.
Thanks.
Your title is Garbology, but that's not a term that you originated. Where does that term come from?
Well, it's got an interesting history, but it became most familiar through the work of an archaeologist by the name of Bill Rathje at the University of Arizona. And he made a study of modern garbage in much the same way archaeologists study what's left behind by ancient civilizations. And he theorized that you could learn a lot about our culture and our habits by looking at our trash. And I think he was right.
So he was the first garbologist.
Yes, that was the term that came to be used for what he does, kind of play on garbage and archaeology, garbology. But it now has come to mean the study of our trash and what we can learn from it. So seemed like a good title.
So this professor at the University of Arizona founded the Garbage Project, and his students then started studying garbage. And I thought it was so interesting, the things that they found, depending on the kinds of trash they would dig through, they could actually tell relative income of the people whose trash they examined.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, obviously our trash reveals a lot about us, everything from our use or misuse of birth control devices to how much alcohol we actually consume versus what we say we consume, which no surprise, perhaps. There's a big disparity there.
Yeah. In fact, he said we overestimate our good habits and underestimate our bad ones.
Yeah, you'd think that this neighborhood in Tucson that he was looking at had cornered the national market on cottage cheese and whole grain products. If you believe what people said, if you looked at your trash, you saw a much greater percentage of potato chip bags and things like that. You know? The funny corollary of that, though, was that people were uncannily accurate in estimating their neighbor's alcohol consumption.
And so they call this the lean cuisine syndrome. We eat good here. We eat really good here.
Yes, exactly. And that shouldn't be surprising, I guess, to anybody. But it's just part of our almost delusional behavior when it comes to our waste, that we don't really see how much or what sorts of trash we make. And of course, that's one of the big problems.
Yeah, in fact, you commented that what we know and what we think we know about garbage are quite different. And one thing I found interesting, too, with this garbage project, that they discovered that if households have a larger trash can, they produce more trash.
Yeah, that's one of Bill Rathje's garbology rules, that trash will always fill whatever void you give it to put it in. So,
so I think you might expect that you could get an idea of relative income of a household, but I think that might surprise people, that you fill up the garbage can no matter what size it is.
Yeah, well, conversely, if you give them a smaller can, they constrain their waste a little bit. So, Yeah, one of the other weird things he found was that communities that tried to do something about toxic and hazardous waste and made these special collection days actually made the problem worse, because invariably people had forgotten all these paint cans and other dangerous things they had piled up in their garages, and then they missed that special day when the collection was supposed to be. And so they just, now that they were conscious of this material, they just hurled it in the regular waste bin and it went where it wasn't supposed to go. So it was not a good way to try and
One of the unintended consequences when they're trying to do something good.
Our waste system is filled with those unintended consequences.
My guest is Edward Humes. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. And I thought it was interesting, too, what they discovered when these students were, the professors were going through garbage. They discovered something about candy. You remember that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. If you want to give something good on Valentine's Day, don't give candy, because it always ended up in the trash. Well, not always, but in great quantities ended up in the trash. Unlike, for instance, Halloween candy, which almost never showed up in the landfill.
So people eat their Halloween candy, but it makes you wonder, well, what was it about Valentine's candy that people ended up not even opening it, perhaps, just throwing it away?
Apparently, people wanted to receive something, other tokens of love than fattening sweet stuff.
Also, the U.S. Census Bureau found that what the students were doing, what they were learning about trash, was something that was helpful for them. Remember that they were trying to calculate two-parent households, and the U.S. Census Bureau had a margin of 40% error when they were trying to calculate this. And so they asked these students, well, help us out here. Help us know how many people really are in the other two parents in this household.
Yeah, well, it turned out to be an excellent tool for drilling down into the demographics that the census couldn't capture, because you could really figure out in large part gender and in some respects age and the number of people in households based upon their trash. And that worked across all demographics too. It was kind of an interesting adjunct, but for a variety of reasons the U.S. Census Bureau decided not to move forward with that particular project. They felt like sorting through people's trash probably was not going to be well received.
Although it was more accurate. Their formula that the students had was an accuracy of more or less 2.5%, and the Census Bureau was off by 40%. So,
yeah, it's not amazing, but yeah. You know, trash doesn't lie.
Yeah, that came out in your book too. Yeah, that what we say or what we think is not necessarily the truth, but our trash tells the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, another thing then I thought was interesting, that the students had the trash delivered to them and they would poke through it, but then one of the professor's colleagues then says, but where's the dirt? And where did that send him, this Professor Rathje? Remember when they asked him, where's the dirt? And so they decided, well, maybe we shouldn't be having the garbage delivered to us. Maybe we should go out and get our hands dirty.
Yeah, they wanted to go and actually explore the disposal point, the landfills, to see what they could reveal and how they behaved, because it turned out when you drill down, as he ended up doing, and get these core samples from our landfills and going down 20, 30 feet into the time machine of our waste, those landfills didn't behave at all as were expected. It was thought everything inside them would decompose and break down, and that was only happening in rather spottily, depending on the type of waste. And other times, things were mummified and perfectly preserved for decades, newsprint articles, even bowls of guacamole. You know, they'd be crusty and nasty on the top, and then you'd wipe away the top layer, and it'd still be green inside after years and years. You know, avocado, one of the most perishable things on the planet, was still identifiable. Hot dogs, well, maybe we shouldn't be surprised they last forever, but
they're full of preservatives.
Exactly. So, yeah, his work in landfills really not only revealed some things about, you know, the nature of our garbage and what people throw away, but revealed new information about the nature of landfills as a disposal solution.
Yeah, because we wouldn't know how that guacamole is, but newspapers, we can see the dates on that. You mentioned in your book that you could dig up a 50-year-old newspaper. It would be intact and readable. You could read about President Truman in this trash that was dug up after 50 years.
Yeah, that was a surprise because, but upon reflection, it made sense because these huge piles of trash we create that we call landfills is a very protected and often airtight environment, and things were preserved. And actually, Rafji argued that was a virtue of landfills, that it kept things from that might be harmful to the environment segregated.
But then those of us who buy things that are biodegradable, that's kind of a disappointment because we think we're doing good if we buy something that's biodegradable. But if it gets in a landfill, it doesn't break down either.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion about how things break down and what they do in the natural environment versus when we put them in landfills. And then you have products, you know, new kinds of potato chip bags or whatever that are labeled compostable or degradable, but the fine print says you have to have really specialized equipment to make it happen. And so our consciences are relieved when we choose products like that. And then it turns out that the benefits are never realized. So there's a lot of confusion on across the board on that, the properties of our waste, so to speak.
My guest is Edward Humes, and his book is Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. And I thought it was interesting, too, that the students in this garbage project, or as they might like to call it, Le Projet du Garbage, because it sounds better in French.
Yeah, that French makes it sound so good.
But I thought this was interesting. They discovered that the more repetitive your diet, the less food you waste. And there's a tremendous lot of food that was wasted. I mean, that comes as a surprise.
But the fact that food waste is enormous.
But that if your diet is more repetitive, you waste less food.
Yeah, and there's a couple of reasons for that, but the main one is, and they saw a good example of this is there was a kind of a meat shortage at one time. Demand was exceeding supply, and so people were either hoarding beef or buying cuts that they were unfamiliar with, and they ended up wasting it because they didn't know how to prepare it well how to treat that particular cut of meat that they were unfamiliar with. And so that ended up creating more waste. And that goes for all sorts of unfamiliar food versus things that we habitually have all the time and we know how to prepare and minimize the wasting.
Well, you know what? I love the story that third graders came up with a way of wasting less food. Remember what they voted for themselves? That they decided that if they paid attention when they were eating, instead of talking so much, they would eat and not have all this food be thrown away.
Yeah, can you imagine that, having a group of third graders impose a silence rule at lunch so they could concentrate on their food and finish before before their meal period was over? That was remarkable. But, you know, it's amazing how simple ideas can alter the trash and waste landscape, and they were so clever in coming up with that.
Yeah, I was really impressed with the third graders who would vote a 20-minute rule of silence at their mealtime so that they could they would waste less food. Well, you have some suggestions in your book. You have five suggestions that you came up with for what we can do about this situation. And I was delighted to see that out of these five suggestions, Ed, two of them were directly related to Chico. And the third one, I don't know if you, because you didn't include this story in your book, but there was a guy who, because I know the fitness club where I go regularly there, a few years back, the bins for recycling water bottles would just fill up practically. I watched it hourly would fill up.
Oh, yeah.
It was so depressing to see that. And one day outside waiting for yoga class to start, this friend of mine said, I have come up with an alternative. It's a reusable stainless steel bottle for water. And he went on to market that this was Robert Seals, and he created the Clean Canteen right here in Chico.
I did not know that.
Well, yeah. So your next book, you could say that Chico was the birthplace of the Clean Canteen, which now you see all over the country. But the story that is wonderful, and Ed, I don't know if you've ever thought about writing a screenplay, but I would love for you to write a screenplay for this story. And that is the story of Chico Bag. How did that get started?
Oh, well, that's, you know, one of those amazing unintended consequences. Andy Keller was going to the landfill that serves Chico and was kind of appalled at what he saw. And one of the If you hang out at any landfill, one of the things you see is the immense amount of plastic bag waste and how hard it is to contain it because they're so light and unless they're tied down or filled with something, they just blow around. In fact, sometimes they can just sort of rise up if the wind currents are right, and it's like having a flock of plastic birds flapping around. And some landfills have people who have to herd them and track them down and keep the plastic bags from escaping into the surrounding environment. So they create a lot of waste issues that really appalled Andy Keller on this visit. And he's driving back and he started seeing plastic bags everywhere by the side of the road. And he didn't know how big a problem it was at that point. He just thought that there had to be a better solution. And that led him to experiment with making a kind of reusable bag. He had just took a buyout in his job in the software industry and was looking around for the next thing in his life. And pretty soon he found himself at a secondhand store buying a sewing machine and experimenting with designing reusable bags. And that was the birth of the reusable Chico bag. And he combined that with some research into the impact and history of plastic bags and felt like that this was a great combination of doing a public good and coming up with a viable business model. And so he founded this company based in Chico.
It's amazing that he had not only the entrepreneurial skill, but the sewing skill.
Yeah, well, he had been a scrapper as a kid, and he had learned how to sew. He had 101 different jobs growing up, and
a lot of them
involved learning sewing.
I mentioned that one of your suggestions was to stop buying bottled water, and this friend of mine that came up with this stainless steel bottle had a skill of working with metal, so he had a talent there that he made use of. And then Andy Keller can sew. and so that was key to his getting started in getting Chico Bag off the ground.
Yeah, so the whole idea behind his work is that it's kind of silly to be consuming 500 disposable grocery bags a year, which is what the average American does, when you could just have a couple of reusable ones and end it right there. Cut off that entire side of our waste production. And he calls plastic bags the gateway drug to waste.
Yes.
And if you could just start with cutting out that particular bit of the waste stream, it can lead to all kinds of other good things and new ways of thinking. He's got a point. It's perverse, is it not, to create a product that is designed to be immediately thrown away as soon as you're done with it, out of materials that last for thousands of years in the environment. I mean, that's the height of paradoxical behavior, and it creates an environmental problem. So a great solution is to bag the bag and use a reusable one.
My guest is Edward Humes, and he is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. But now, Andy's success, though, brought along, it started to be a problem, but then it turned out to be something good that happened, and that is he attracted the attention of these big manufacturers of plastic bags. And then what?
Yeah, well, he became a very vocal advocate for reducing plastic bag waste and use. And he did a couple of things. One of them was to create this alter ego, this character he called Bag Monster. And he made this costume out of 500 plastic grocery bags. The idea being that represents our annual individual consumption. He looked like this, a monster made out of plastic bags. It was an incredibly puffy looking thing. And he'd go out to schools and he'd do public awareness campaigns. And people started asking to borrow it. And he ended up creating, something like 100 of these loner costumes, and Bag Monster is pretty popular. It's got its own website now and everything. So that started drawing the kind of attention to plastic bags that manufacturers and of plastic bags didn't care for. And he combined that with a website that presented some information about plastic bags and their use and their impact on the environment that the plastic bag industry took issue with, and they ended up suing him. And accusing him of spreading false information that harmed their businesses.
Yeah, because they can't have this. They can't have reusable grocery bags. We got to make an example of this guy.
Well, that's what Andy Keller felt, that he was being singled out, and as a critic, he had support. He was campaigning for, and Bag Monster was campaigning for city and town restrictions and bans on plastic bags, and that certainly was a threat to the plastic bag industry. So they, you know, identified what they thought were was false information, and on his website went after him. It was a very clever legal campaign. It was filed in a state on the East Coast that doesn't have anti-SLAPP laws, which in California could have led to a quick dismissal of this particular lawsuit. And it's a very costly thing to litigate this sort of action. But he ended up fighting it, and hired a bunch of experts and was able to show that the information he presented was factual or based on the best data,
or even understated,
or even understated. The amount of plastic that we use may actually be much greater than his website asserted. So, and it wasn't, he wasn't making stuff up. He was quoting authoritative sources like the EPA and the Los Angeles Times and so forth. So it ended up settling. Both sides claimed victory, but the bottom line was that more and more communities are going with Mr. Keller's vision and are adopting these restrictions and bans on plastic bags.
So Andy Keller sees recycling as a crutch to allow us to feel better about our overconsumption of disposable things. But there's another story in your book. Bea Johnson makes us feel good about, she says it's not a sacrifice to recycle. In fact, she has four R's. What are her four R's?
Yeah. Well, in addition to the usual recycle, reduce, reuse, she adds refuse. Not to be confused with refuse, but refuse the waste. Refuse the overpackaged and wasteful products. Refuse to buy the single use and disposable things, and insist on the durable. The reusable, the thing that you can take into your home and say, this is something I want in my life for the duration, that I want to pass on to my children, as opposed to buying things that you know are going to end up in the trash very quickly. And when you make that kind of switch in your thinking, you really change your habits of consumption. In some respects, you downsize your life. In fact, that's what provoked this in the first place. She and her family moved from a very large house to a smaller one, and they suddenly realized they had a lot of stuff that they had no room for. And then they realized they had a lot of stuff they didn't need. Yes, do we really need three sets of china? Do we really need that second couch that nobody sits on because it's so darn uncomfortable? Do we really need this, that, and that? And boy, did we spend a lot of money on stuff we didn't really need or want. And that led to a soul-searching and a rethinking. So, when Bea goes to the supermarket, she brings her own containers, whether it's to get deli meat or cereal or what have you. She tries and buy unpackaged in bulk. And she found out a couple things. Either that really didn't have any financial impact on her, but it certainly lowered the amount of waste she was generating, or it was actually cheaper to buy in bulk, to buy in large quantities. She does things like buy a large container of vinegar and make cleaning products out of that with a little Castile soap, which is a chemical-free liquid soap. And those are the only cleaning products she needs for her house, instead of the, six or eight tile cleaners and spray cleaners and thing in single-use plastic bottles that cost so much more.
But, people are going to resist that. I don't want to take reusable containers to the grocery store. And this is true through in all aspects of our life, really. It's easier to oppose, and you make this point, it's easier to oppose change than to propose it. And, for example, there's a woman who picks up trash on the beach, and people love to go join her picking up trash on the beach because it makes us feel good. But admitting that we lead wasteful lives that need to change does not make us feel good. You make this point in your book. Something like picking up the trash, we feel good about that, but we don't want to admit that our lives are wasteful and we need to change that. But, Bea has an interesting point, too. Her husband calculated that they saved 40% on their household budget by these changes they made in their lifestyle.
Yeah, and that's certainly a big incentive, because when you make decisions that reduce waste, that focus on, you know, getting things that are durable and long-lasting rather than disposable and have to be replaced all the time, and you buy efficiently in bulk and all those things, you save a lot of money. Even if you don't give a darn about the fate of the planet or future generations, you have a great incentive to build in
level.
Less waste. Because what is waste? Waste is wasting stuff. It's that stuff has value, and we're paying for it. And, there's a reason why our grandparents told us to clean our plates and not waste stuff, because it makes sense. And because they didn't have so much money to waste as we seem to have now.
Well,
we're creatures of habit. We're creatures of habit. And all we have to do is adopt a new habit, a less wasteful habit, and then that becomes the norm. It's just that transition that's hard.
Well, and as a community, we recently are faced with closing a fire station. And you make the point that our communities spend more on waste management than on fire protection, parks and recreations, libraries, or school books. And I think people realize that would be a motivation. No, don't close our fire station, but maybe we could consider how we manage waste. Because you make that point that trash is our leading export. That's our leading product.
Yeah.
We produce trash.
Scrap metal and scrap paper is our number one export to China, and our leading exporter in this country in terms of the amount of containers she ships is a trash merchant. China's first female billionaire, as a matter of fact, made her fortune on American trash.
And you say that in the United States, one out of six big trucks is a garbage truck. I think that would shock people. One out of six big trucks is a garbage truck. I think there's so
awesome.
Many statistics in your book that make us really, made me stop and think. For example, when I look at cemeteries filling up and I think, well, maybe we should look more at cremation. And then I saw your statistic that body would just occupy one cemetery plot, but our garbage would be the equivalent of 1,100 graves, 1,100 graves. The space.
Isn't that amazing? It is.
And I found interesting that you throw in history of garbage, like the times when pigs used to be used to eat garbage, but we found
not that long ago.
Yeah, right. But the meat was quite inferior and not even very, obviously very healthy, to use that system.
The impulse was good, though. It was to take food waste and find something useful for it, rather than just burying it in landfills. And the reason that fell from popularity in the 50s and 60s was the requirement caused by concerns over disease that the garbage, the food waste, be sterilized before it was fed to the pigs. And that added cost, and the whole idea of it faded away. But yeah, that's the idea of using our food waste for feed had been around for hundreds of years. It had its downsides, but it had its upsides too, because we were thinking still about the usefulness of those materials rather than just viewing them as sort of worthless things we should pile somewhere or bury somewhere. And so in some ways, we've actually gone backwards on the waste front.
So you have made us very aware of what we can do. I mentioned you have five suggestions, and stop buying bottled water, quit using plastic grocery bags. So I hope people will really take this book to heart, because it is a fascinating read, and it's things that I think people would not have thought about and will now give thought to. I now, when I look at the Eiffel Tower, think there's a garbage power plant less than 3 miles from the Eiffel Tower. So thank you so much, Ed, for being my guest today. It's been a pleasure.
Same here.
My guest is Edward Humes. His book is Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. After a break, I'll ask Reading author Steve Westall how he came to write a novel he calls New Hope Island. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Reading author Steve Westall was raised on a farm in Ohio. He worked in the wholesale drug business for 25 years. After becoming disenchanted with the pressures of big business, he became a small business owner. In the 1990s, he went back to school and got his securities and broker's licenses and went to work for a financial services company in Reading. Over the years, he did a lot of technical writing and a few short stories. He has now written his first novel, New Hope Island. Steve Westall, welcome.
Hi.
I know you're a member of the Writers Forum in Reading, and what is that?
The Writers Forum is a group of, an informal group of writers and aspiring writers and people just interested in reading and associating with writers as a whole.
Well, now you describe yourself, I think, as a writer's advocate. And what does that involve?
Well, it's writer slash advocate.
Uh-huh.
I'm a writer and I do some advocating for various groups and people, primarily senior citizens.
So you are kind of an ombudsman.
Absolutely.
For these other
yes.
groups. So these are two different hats.
Two different things.
Yeah. So when you go to your writer's forum, what is your role in participating in the writer's forum?
Well, the writer's forum has a program every month, which is on a timely subject. And it's either an outside speaker or some of the people that have had some success in writing. And we twice a year have a read-around that gives everyone an opportunity, if they want to read parts of their books in progress or books that they've had published. And we also have a number of poets that are in the Writers' Forum. Actually, quite a few of very talented poets, and they read their poetry.
Does your business background come in handy when you are giving tips, maybe about marketing? Because that's a big problem, I guess I'll use the word problem, for writers these days, is how to market. Once you've written it, that's kind of the easy part.
Well, I spent all my life in marketing, so that's it helps, of course.
Well, in your book, your main character hates to fly. So I'm wondering if I read this, I wonder if Steve Westall hates to fly.
Not really. It's not one of my favorite things. In my career, I had a few years, 10 or so, that I flew almost every day. I can't say that I really loved it, but it wasn't. It really wasn't that bad.
So your character, you kind of exaggerate that
yes.
as far as your own experience with him. Because the whole time I was reading it, I was thinking, okay, now I think Steve had this in common with his main character. Your main character's name, Jim.
Jim.
And from what I was reading happening to Jim, I thought, that echoes what it seems like Steve went through in his life. So you draw on that. But now you set this story in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And you were from Ohio. Had you an experience in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania?
Yes. I spent time in Harrisburg, in Pittsburgh, in Columbus, Ohio, Toledo, Ohio, through the Midwest. But I particularly like Harrisburg. It's a nice, quaint town on the river, two rivers, actually. And it seemed like when I got into a place where my gym should come from. Harrisburg was a nice place for a middle-of-the-road, middle-aged man trying to make his way in the world.
In fact, as you describe this Jim Johnson, he does seem like he could be anybody. You say if you're married, you might have these experiences that Jim had, or if you're not married, you could go through these emotional ups and downs that your main character experiences.
That's right. One of the premises of my story, and I call them stories, a lot of people call them books, but my story is that that he is an average man that's facing the problems that an educated businessman with a family and all of the things that go along with that what that life is in the middle, and that's exactly where he is.
Well, one reason I thought about his being you're incorporating some of your life, because, for example, your character goes to Ohio State.
Yes.
And he and his girlfriend decide to get married. And then you went to Ohio State. In fact, you got a degree in agriculture.
Yes.
From Ohio State. and that you married your high school girlfriend.
Yes, also from Ohio.
So there are these similarities that you incorporate into your story for your main character with your own life.
Well, this isn't a story about my life, but of course,
you draw on it because that's what you know.
That in my life have a great influence on a lot of the things. A lot of the business aspects of the story are from my life experience, and that's, I think, a lot of writers, at least on, in particular, their first book, you draw on what you know best.
Because then it seems more real to the rest of us as you're reading this. Now, your story is told in the first person.
Yes.
So I open the book and I hear this I, but not all of the stories are that same person.
No.
So you read along and you open a new chapter and the person saying I turns out to be a woman.
Yes. It's the book is divided into two main areas. It's a real life experience and a dream experience. And the dream experience gives me an opportunity to explore maybe another, not maybe, but another person, and how that person becomes part of the dream part of the book, some of that person's real life experiences as it folds over into the actual dream of Jim Johnson.
Okay, well, let's see who this, and you tell it in Jim's words, let's see what's going on. And often you say Jim's real life or Shelley's real life, but when you start in the prologue, you say real life because it could be anybody's
right.
real life. So read this prologue for us. And this is real life. And you say in everyone's life, there's at least one good story. Mine, and this is, again, Jim Johnson speaking, pick up there.
Mine's a four-year journey that has dropped right in the middle, just where most of us expect to be enjoying our best years, filled with a great Sunday romance wife, exceptional children, and a dream job. My story is an entirely different picture. It turns out my life is just simply blown up. I'm having problems in my marriage and unexpected problems in my job. Now I know what the midlife trauma and marriage blow-ups. Now I know what midlife trauma and marriage blow-ups are not unusual stories. In fact, they're a dime a dozen. Some have written that walking the length of the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Crest Trails helped them bring their lives back into focus and helped them mull over their futures. Others have written books on the power of religion, yoga, and meditation as dilemma cures. Many of them are inspiring stories and even full of adventure. The fact is, even though my story is not unusual, the way I've chosen to deal with the everyday stress of the blow-up is to escape into a dream world. It happened quite by accident, the dream. The mental anxiety of my wife leaving me, fear of losing my job, and an intense aversion to flying led me to an horrific nightmare one hot summer night. The nightmare has turned into a continuing dream, becoming so extraordinarily real, it's like having another consciousness inside my mind.
My guest is Reading author Steve Westall. He's reading from his new novel, New Hope Island. And you say that some have written that walking the length of the Appalachian or Pacific Coast Trails help them get their lives back into focus. And I don't have experience, well, a little bit on the Appalachian Trail, I take that back, or I don't have any experience on the Pacific Crest Trail, but I've walked the medieval pilgrimage across Spain and France, and these are the stories that I heard. You'd walk along, you'd meet another pilgrim, and they would say, well, I lost my job, and I'm not sure what to do, so I'm on this pilgrimage to kind of find myself. Or one nice gentleman from Australia, we talked to her for a good while, and he wasn't willing to talk about it yet, but then he said, my wife left me, and I'm not sure what to do here. And here is Jim, your character, saying his life is blown up, not just his professional life, his home life, everything is in crumble and is in shambles.
Well, we're all pilgrims.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that.
It's just sometimes we don't use that word, but it's such a wonderful word.
It is, and these pilgrims go to, that's their solution. And what Jim says, that he has chosen to deal with the everyday stress of the blow up by escaping into a dream world.
Yes.
And so the very next paragraph in your book, so that was real life, very next paragraph is the dream. And particularly if you've got your main character living in the Midwest, where it's cold and snowy and the sun doesn't always shine, boy, what, how nice it would be to escape to a South Pacific island.
Particularly if you fold in a little Jack Daniels.
So I'm wondering if, and that's Jim talking there, but I'm wondering if when you, maybe you were growing up in the Midwest and you're thinking, boy, you know, a nice sunny island would be so nice.
Well, I was raised in the country in northwestern Ohio, and it, what you may not know, but Columbus, Ohio, where Ohio State is, has the least sunny days of any city in the United States. So I often thought, if I could just go to the Bahamas or Bermuda, not Florida, or some tropical island for just a few days in February, I could perform my job and my family with my family a lot better.
And the weather still wasn't necessarily good in March, because by spring break, my husband was saying, let's go to Acapulco, let's go to Hawaii. And we would do that.
Absolutely.
And he would get his dose of sunshine to go back and face the Midwestern winters. So here's Jim, this character that describes this wonderful island that he could go to. So when people ask you what your book is about, what do you tell them?
Well, I say that, first of all, when someone knows or they hear that you've written a book, the first thing they ask you is what it's about. And my answer is, well, if you've been married, you have children, if you've been divorced, if you've lost your job, if you've been laid off, if you've been downsized, and maybe you might even be single and had those things happen to you, wouldn't it be nice if there was a place that you could go, even if it was in your mind, that would relieve that stress? And that's what my story's about.
And the cover of your book, you have blue skies and seagulls, and the words floating through these clouds, dream, joy, love, hope. Because I think sometimes if you get in those situations, that hope might be in short supply.
Eps.
My guest is Steve Westall, and he has a new novel, New Hope Island. And on the cover it says, everyone deserves their own New Hope Island. Well, Jim works for, he's in the world of business.
Yes.
And your second chapter, Jim in real life, and he's living in Harrisburg. And he goes to the office. It's a relatively new building there. And you write, this is Steve writing, having a personal parking space is a coveted company perk. And you say there are tons of good parking spaces in the company parking lot, but one with your name and number on it in the front of the building is a big deal. So does Jim have his own parking space?
Has his own parking space. It's not number one, but it's number two.
Number two, reserved for number two, Johnson. And was this the case for you, that you had a parking space with your name on it?
When you're working, and particularly if you're working for a large company, a parking space is a huge perk, and it usually has something to do with the pecking order. But the old saying was, the parking space goes with the desk, or the desk goes with the parking space, whichever. So, and particularly in Columbus, Ohio, or Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in the Midwest, a parking spot becomes important because of the winters.
Well, you hear about the corner office, so you work your way up to the corner office. So when you were in business, you were in this, and Jim works for a, what company does he work for? What does his company do?
He works for a company called Rudinger, which is a wholesale drug company which distributes pharmaceuticals and health and beauty aids to drugstores.
So the author, you, Steve Westall, writes from what you know.
I did that.
And what was your experience working for this prepackaged prescription drugs?
Well, one of the dilemmas in the book, as you get deeper into it, is that that business was a downsizing business. When Jim started, and even when I started, there were two or three, 2,400 wholesale drug companies in the United States. Today, there are only 10. So consolidation and downsizing has been a real factor, and it really has affected a lot of employees and people.
Well, when I was growing up in my hometown, there was literally a corner drugstore just about every corner. They were owned by your neighbor. The pharmacist owned his little drugstore. And now you ride down the street and you see these huge drugstores, and CVS and Walgreens are buying up all these smaller. So you have your character going through a rough time at his job.
Yes. Rough time at his job. His company is in the process of being purchased or gobbled up, I call it, by another larger company. And as we go on through the book, the company that he goes with, because he stays with the company that acquires his company, is also acquired by another company.
So Jim is going through a tough time and thinking, oh, golly, wouldn't it be nice to escape somewhere? And that's the dream part.
Yes.
Getting to this island. But there's a nightmarish part of his story. And what is the nightmare?
Well, the nightmare is related to his aversion to flying. When the second company bought his current company, they offered him an opportunity to go on a buying trip to the Orient, which involved, from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, a large amount of distance and flying. And that's what set him into the dream, worrying about that flight.
So this dream is actually a nightmare. What happens on the flight in the dream?
He crashes.
That's a person who hates flying. That's the worst thing they can imagine.
That's right.
To crash.
And he crashes in a private plane that they had. So and as far as surviving when he waking up on this island, which was a large deserted island in the South Pacific, he later determined he was the only survivor.
So your character, his plane that he's on crashes on this island, but of course this is the island in his imagination.
He's dreaming.
And another appeal of being able to escape into a dream life is that not only are things not going well professionally, but what's going on meanwhile back at the ranch?
Well, of course, that's how he got into the problems onto the island. The crash and the few initial problems that he had was because his life in real time was not going well at all either.
So he marries his college. They get married in college at Ohio State, and things just go fine for maybe 10 or 12 years. But they've been married now for 14 years. What happens?
Well, he was working to provide for his family, and also
he has two daughters in the story.
Two daughters, and
12 and 14.
When you get into an executive role, it not only becomes working for your family, but also working for yourself, because there's a certain drive there. And he just lost it, and his wife just didn't want to live with him anymore. She was looking for something outside of just company functions and going on trips that were all company sponsored and associating with Jim's associates, and really not having any friends that she considered to be fun outside of his work. So it was a difficult situation for her. She had no life except Jim's life and her two daughters' life.
And she's a very attractive woman.
Very attractive woman.
And she had her own career.
Had her own career.
So here she is, I start to say stuck at home, but that's kind of the way it becomes for her. She's not working. And what had her career been?
She was a nurse, a registered nurse, and had worked for a number of years, and a very good nurse. And she just wanted to have some association with the professions again. And in her current situation, she felt she couldn't do that.
Well, at one point, he encourages her to go back to nursing, to get a job at any rate.
Well, yes, but in a negative sense, I guess, when you get in trouble with your marriage, you start to say, well, why don't you do this or why don't you do that or call your sister or something?
Yeah, and he sought professional help.
Yes.
And how did that work for him?
Well, it worked out okay. He heard what he did, what he already knew, and his wife, whose name was Christy, by the way, told her side of the story. But when the advisor, who was a pastor in this particular point, came back to Jim telling him what his wife had discussed, he said, well, it's really not much use for you and I and Christy to get together because I really believe that she's going to leave and that's the way it's going to be. So you might as well start making some other plans.
Well, it's easy for the reader to side with Jim. I mean, he's the one telling the story after all. He's telling it from his point of view. But here, when he has to go looking for his wife, of course, he tells the bartender, well, I'm looking for my sister. And right. What does the bartender say? Yeah, yeah. What does the bartender say when this guy tells him he's looking for his sister?
Heard that a million times.
Yeah. So he looks for her, and he finds her there in this bar. She's not by herself. Who is she with?
Well, she's with another man, and obviously that's disconcerting for, although he knew that something was going on, it has to be disconcerting when you actually witness the situation.
Sees her right there with this other guy.
Right, yes.
And so that's why I say, well, the reader, here she is, this adulteress that he's married to, this poor guy. And so we kind of, I think, you paint Christy maybe as a villain.
Yes.
Does she have...
Yes.
Did you give her some redeeming qualities?
Yes. She did love her daughters. She didn't really want to spend any in her current emotional state. She didn't want to spend much time with them. She wanted to explore. But in the end, with the counseling that Jim received, he realized that it wasn't all her fault, that it really was his fault, and not just in recent years either, actually almost from the beginning, that he really wasn't doing what he should be doing in his relationship with his wife.
So when you have him, when they realize, okay, this marriage is, we can't redeem this marriage, we're going to get a divorce. So when you have him sit down with his attorney, you go into detail, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, Steve sounds like he's writing this from experience.
No, I'm not. That's just what happens. Maybe I watch too much TV, you know. With.
So what does the lawyer tell him then? What advice does the lawyer give him?
Well, the lawyer told him to not say much because he had some assets, and it was Pennsylvania's a community property state, and his wife was going to get half of it anyway, so there really wasn't a lot of reason to make a big issue out of the settlement. And in the end, that's pretty much the way that it happened.
Well, you kind of, this person, Christy, does kind of redeem ourselves in the reader's eyes because she is not vengeful. She doesn't say, I want half of everything.
No.
What's her response to this divorce?
She signed off and just said, you know, it's whatever's fair is fair, 50-50, because they had done everything 50-50 their entire life. He worked while she went to college, and she worked while he went to college. So it was a mutual deal, and she deserved half of what they had done together.
My guest is Steve Westall. He's written a novel, New Hope Island, and he says that everybody deserves their own island. And what is the nature of this island? What is the appeal? Because it's a dream. It's a dream that he has concocted to escape to this island. And what is so appealing about this island?
Well, the appeal is from Jim's standpoint is that he has to be resourceful, and everything he does is in his control. And if he's successful at gathering bananas as a basic, or gathering fish or fishing, it was all him, which related back to his life in real life, which in his mind he had lost control of. So in his dream, his mindset was that everything he did, he had control over, and his success was dependent only on himself.
Because when he's working for the company, he doesn't have control over his destiny there. And
no longer has control
over his home
wife.
Yes, his wife. And so here he's on this island. If he wants some bananas, he has bananas. And I appreciated your little touch there of mentioning Kroger's, which people here in California, what's Kroger's? Never heard of that. But if you're from the Midwest, that's
right.
A big grocery store.
Yes.
So that's where he would go to shop for bananas.
Yes.
So that added a realistic touch. And so he, on this island, he is in control.
Yes.
What else is appealing about this island?
Well, of course, the weather. And as we get in deep into the story, we'll find that some other things pop up that that change the whole complexion of the island.
Well, I won't spoil the surprises in your book for the reader so that they can read this and find out what's going on this island. And I want to thank you for coming in from Reading and telling us about your new novel, Steve.
I appreciate being here. Thank you.
The novel is New Hope Island, and the author is Steve Westall. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Edward Humes, author of Garbology. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.